This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Leiden, December 1883. The city's canals reflected the gray December sky, fog creeping through narrow streets lined with textile mills. Coal smoke hung thick in the air, mixing with the damp chill that seeped through every crack in the workers' cottages. In this ancient university town, birthplace of Rembrandt, the poor lived crowded into slums, where disease was so common that death barely raised an eyebrow. On a cold morning in one of Leiden's roughest neighborhoods, a man named Hendrik Frankhausen woke to pain that wouldn't stop. His wife, Maria, had died just days earlier. Their six-month-old son had followed her to the grave shortly after. Both had suffered the same agonizing symptoms: relentless diarrhea, violent vomiting, pain that twisted their insides until they couldn't endure anymore. The doctor had called it cholera. In Leiden slums, cholera killed regularly. No one questioned it. But now Hendrik was experiencing the same unbearable pain. His stomach felt like it was being torn apart from the inside. He couldn't keep food down. He couldn't keep water down. The weakness was overwhelming. Something was wrong. This wasn't just bad luck. This wasn't just another poor family in Leiden's disease-ridden streets, losing members to the endemic sickness that plagued working-class neighborhoods. Hendrik dragged himself to his local doctor's office, desperate for help. The doctor examined him, asked about his symptoms, took careful notes. Then he asked a question that would change everything. Who's been caring for you? Who's been preparing your meals? My sister-in-law, Hendrik said. Maria. Maria Swanenberg. She's been so kind, bringing us food, helping with the baby before he died. Everyone calls her Goamia, Good Mary. She's always helping people. The doctor went still. He'd seen another patient that very week with identical symptoms. Same street, same neighborhood, and when he'd asked who'd been caring for that patient, he'd heard the same name, Maria Swanenberg. The doctor had been practicing medicine in Leiden for years. He knew these symptoms. He'd seen them before in patients who lived near Maria Swanenberg. Patients who'd been under her care. Patients who trusted the woman everyone called the angel of their neighborhood. But these weren't symptoms of cholera or typhoid or any other disease that killed the poor in Victorian Leiden. These were the symptoms of arsenic poisoning, and Maria Swanenberg had been poisoning the people of Leiden for years. Hello, friend. Welcome to Foul Play.
Born in 1839 to Clemens Swanenberg and Johanna Dingjon, a working-class family in Leiden, Maria Katharina Swanenberg grew up in modest circumstances during a time of significant industrial growth in the Netherlands. Her early years were marked by the hardships typical of working-class life in the 19th century. With her father working long hours in Tilburg's booming textile industry, while her mother managed their humble household, we found a description of her house from a book written by historian Stefan Glasbergen. quote, "You entered through a tiny front room, and that was where her parents slept. In the back of the house there was a small kitchen, but they often cooked outside. The children slept on the first floor, right underneath the roof. The space was not insulated. When it rained, it got wet. When the wind blew, you felt it inside," end quote. Clemens Swanenberg struggled to hold down a job, and when Maria was just 12, the family fell behind on their rent and were evicted. They moved to Stengelstrasse, a very rough neighbourhood, full of the poorest workers in the city. Stefan Glasenberg says, quote, "The neighbours who later testified during the criminal trial said the girls never really went outside. They'd knit clothes all day long, which were later to be sold," end quote. It was perfectly normal back then for this to be the case in poorer households. Despite limited formal education due to barely attending school, Maria proved to be resourceful and intelligent from an early age. She learned the essential skills of housekeeping and caregiving from her mother, abilities that would later become central to both her legitimate work and her sinister activities. Those who knew her as a child would later recall her as quiet but helpful, always willing to lend a hand to neighbours in need. After the death of two of her daughters at a young age, Maria married Johannes van der Linden on the 13th of May 1868, signing her marriage certificate with an X. Johannes was a labourer. The couple settled into a small house in the working district of Tilburg, where they would go on to have five sons and two daughters. Johannes was the father of all of Maria's children, but some were born prior to their marriage. This created a lot of gossip and speculation, and Maria was deemed sexually promiscuous. Life was not easy for the family, but Maria's resourcefulness helped them maintain a modest but stable existence. She supplemented their income by taking in boarders and caring for elderly neighbours, gradually building a reputation as a trustworthy caregiver in the community. As the years passed, Maria became known throughout her neighbourhood as someone who could be relied upon in times of need. She was particularly sought after for her willingness to care for the sick and elderly, a valuable service in an era before widespread institutional care. Her house became a makeshift nursing home, where she would take in those who needed attention and care. Neighbours praised her seemingly endless patience and dedication to her charges, never suspecting the dark intentions that lay beneath her benevolent exterior. The community's trust in Maria grew stronger with each passing year. She was often called upon to prepare bodies for funerals, a common practice in Dutch communities at the time. Her knowledge of death and dying, gained through these experiences, would later prove to be dangerously convenient for her criminal activities. Yet in these early years, she was simply seen as a hard-working woman who had found her calling in caring for others. However, Maria was battling demons, and her difficult childhood, plus losing two of her children, left a lasting impact on her mental health, and she turned to alcohol to numb the pain.
The killing began in 1880. Maria's first victims were the two people who'd brought her into this world: her mother, Doana Dingen, her father, Clemens Swanenberg, both poisoned with arsenic, both dead within months of each other. And these murders happened in Leiden, the city where Maria had grown up, where she'd built her reputation as Joemi, where everyone knew her as the kind woman who helped the sick and elderly. Not Tilburg, as sometimes gets confused in the historical record, but Leiden, the ancient university city on the Rhine, where Rembrandt was born, where textiles brought prosperity to factory owners, while workers died young in overcrowded slums. In 1880s Leiden, death was everywhere. Cholera epidemics swept through working-class neighborhoods regularly. Typhoid, tuberculosis, smallpox, they killed so frequently that additional deaths barely registered. Families of 10 or 12 people lived in tiny cottages with no sanitation, no ventilation, earthen floors and cellar rooms, where the damp never left. Child mortality was staggeringly high. Doctors rarely visited poor districts because the poor couldn't pay. This was the perfect environment for a poisoner. When Joanna Dingen died after days of violent illness, her symptoms looked like cholera, the same disease that killed working-class Leiden residents constantly. When Clemens Swanenberg followed his wife to the grave shortly after, suffering identical symptoms, it seemed like tragic bad luck. A poor family struck by disease. No one suspected their daughter had murdered them both. Maria had discovered something crucial. Arsenic was easy to obtain. Victorian pharmacies sold it for pest control with minimal regulation. You could walk into any pharmacy in Leiden and buy arsenic. No questions asked, no records kept. Maria was smart about it. She never bought enough from one location to arouse suspicion. Instead, she made small purchases from multiple pharmacies across Leiden, accumulating lethal quantities without any single pharmacist noticing a pattern. The poison itself was nearly perfect for murder. When administered correctly, arsenic was tasteless and odorless. The symptoms it caused, severe gastric distress, relentless diarrhea and vomiting, dehydration, organ failure, looked exactly like cholera, typhoid, or any number of endemic diseases that killed the poor regularly. Medical knowledge in 1880s Netherlands was limited. Doctors couldn't distinguish between arsenic poisoning and disease without chemical analysis. And chemical analysis was expensive, rare, and not routinely performed. Even if a doctor suspected poisoning, proving it was nearly impossible. Maria developed a method. She'd offer to care for someone, usually elderly, usually sick, always poor. She'd bring them food, make them tea or coffee, prepare their meals. She'd add small amounts of arsenic to their food and drink. The victim would start showing symptoms that looked like illness. Maria would be the first to suggest calling a doctor, would express concern, would stay by their bedside as they deteriorated. When they died, she'd help prepare the body for burial. She'd console the grieving family. She'd attend the funeral. And then she'd collect on the life insurance policies she'd secretly taken out on them. But here's what makes Maria Swanenberg's story so chilling. Despite the insurance fraud, she remained poor. She owed money to businesses around Leiden. Her family lived modestly throughout her killing spree. The insurance payouts, and there were many, never seemed to improve her circumstances. Money was part of her motive, but it wasn't the whole story. After her parents, Maria expanded her victim selection. A nephew, other relatives, elderly neighbors she'd taken in as boarders, people who trusted her completely, people who saw her as Huhemi, the good woman who cared for those no one else would help. She varied the intervals between murders, ensuring no pattern emerged. She spread her activities across neighborhoods in Leiden. When questions about the frequent deaths among those in her care, she'd say she took on the most seriously ill patients, the ones others refused to help. Of course, her patients died more often. They were the sickest to begin with. It was a perfect cover, and it worked for years. The people of Leiden had no idea they were living alongside a serial killer. Someone who attended church regularly. Someone known for charitable works. Someone whose reputation for compassion made the idea of her being a murderer seem impossible to contemplate. But Maria Swanenberg was killing steadily, methodically, for 3 years, and she wasn't done yet.
The exact number of Swanenberg's victims remains uncertain to this day, with 27 confirmed, over 102 possibly poisoned, at least 90 resulting in death. Among these were not only her elderly charges, but also several family members, including her own parents and nephew. She also murdered two sisters she was babysitting for, and then at their wake poisoned some of their relatives too. Stefan Glasbergen's book says, quote, "They survived, but she attempted murdering six people, including the pregnant mother of the dead sisters," end quote. These familial murders demonstrated a particularly cold-blooded aspect of her character, as she showed no hesitation in poisoning those closest to her when opportunity or necessity arose. Her method of avoiding detection was remarkably simple, yet effective. She maintained a caring and concerned demeanour throughout each victim's decline, often being the first to suggest medical attention when symptoms appeared. She would attend funerals, console grieving families, and even assist with funeral arrangements. This public display of empathy and support helped deflect any potential suspicion away from her. Swanenberg was meticulous in varying the intervals between murders, never allowing a pattern to emerge that might attract attention. She also spread her activities across different neighbourhoods in Tilburg, ensuring that no single area experienced an unusual spike in deaths. When questioned about the frequent deaths among those in her care, she would attribute it to her willingness to take on the most seriously ill patients whom others had refused to help. One of her most effective tactics was to establish herself as a pillar of the community, regularly attending church and maintaining a reputation for charitable works. This carefully cultivated image of a devout, compassionate woman created a cognitive dissonance that made it difficult for anyone to consider her capable of murder, even as the death toll continued to rise. The very idea that this seemingly kind-hearted caregiver could be systematically poisoning her charges seemed too fantastic to contemplate. The eventual scale of her crimes was staggering, particularly considering the size of Tilburg at the time. In a community where everyone knew their neighbours, Swanenberg managed to kill repeatedly over several years without arousing serious suspicion. Her victims died in their own homes, often with their families nearby, never knowing that their trusted caregiver was actually their murderer. The first signs of suspicion arose when local doctors began noticing an unusual pattern of deaths among Swanenberg's patients. While individual cases hadn't raised the alarm, the cumulative number of deaths was becoming difficult to ignore.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
But Maria Swanenberg made a mistake. Actually, she made two. Two terrible, brazen crimes that would finally bring her decades of murder into the light. The first was at a wake. Maria had been babysitting two young sisters. Both died under her care, poisoned with arsenic like so many others. At their wake, as grieving relatives gathered in a cramped Leiden cottage to mourn the dead children, Maria brought food. She'd poisoned it. Six people ate what Maria brought. Six people, including the girls' pregnant mother, became violently ill with the telltale symptoms. Severe gastric distress, relentless vomiting, pain that felt like their insides were being torn apart. By some miracle, all six survived. but this was extraordinary. Poisoning 6 people at once, at a funeral for children she'd already murdered. It was bold to the point of recklessness. It was the kind of escalation that suggested Maria felt completely untouchable. And in Leiden's disease-ridden slums, where death was so normal that people barely blinked, she almost was untouchable. But that wake poisoning planted seeds of suspicion in the community. Whispers started, quiet questions about why so many people got sick after eating food Maria had prepared. Why so many of Maria's patients died. Why the woman everyone called Gohiami seemed to be surrounded by death.
The breakthrough in the case finally came in December 1883, when Swanenburg poisoned the Frankhausen family. The father of the family, Henrik, a man from an extremely poor neighborhood, went to his local doctor after experiencing unbearable pain for a few days. This poor man had already lost his wife and newborn son to similar symptoms, including relentless diarrhea and vomiting, which had been put down to cholera, a disease prevalent in the area at this time. His doctor recognized the symptoms. In fact, he had seen another patient just that week with the exact same complaint, who happened to live on the same street as Henrik. The doctor became suspicious that someone could be poisoning his patients. Sadly, Henrik could not be saved, and he died 11 days later in a nearby hospital. However, his death kicked off the police investigation. And the person who was on the police radar? None other than Henrik's sister-in-law, Maria Swanenburg.
Dr. Wiegeland Reuters Vanderloof was the physician who finally connected the dots. When Hendrik Frankenhausen came to his office in December 1883, barely able to stand, describing symptoms that had already killed his wife and infant son, the doctor's mind went to a dark place. These weren't cholera symptoms, even though cholera was the easy diagnosis in Leiden slums. The presentation was wrong. The pattern was wrong. And when Dr. Vanderloof asked who'd been caring for the family, who'd been bringing them food, the answer made everything click into place. Maria Swanenburg. The same name he'd heard just days earlier from another patient with identical symptoms. Another patient from the same street, another patient who'd been under Maria's care. The doctor had been practicing in Leiden long enough to know Maria's reputation. Gohiami, the angel of the neighborhood. The woman who cared for people no one else would help. The woman who prepared bodies for funerals, who consoled grieving families, who seemed to be everywhere death touched the poor. Too many of her patients had died. Too many people under her care had suffered these specific symptoms. And now a father, a wife, and an infant, an entire family, had been struck down with the same presentation, and Maria Swanenburg had been bringing them food. Dr. Vanderloof went to the police. Hendrik Frankenhausen died 11 days later in the hospital, arsenic destroying his organs beyond recovery. But his death wasn't in vain. His death launched the investigation that would finally stop Maria Swanenburg. On December 15, 1883, police arrested Maria Swanenburg. When they searched her, they found insurance policies in her pockets. Policies taken out on multiple people under her care. Policies that would pay out when those people died. It wasn't proof of murder, not yet. But it was enough to hold her, enough to start digging deeper. And what the police found when they started digging would shock the Netherlands.
The trial of Maria Swanenburg began on the 23rd of April 1885, drawing unprecedented attention from across the Netherlands. The prosecution presented a methodically prepared case, focusing on the deaths of 27 individuals where evidence was strongest. though they acknowledged the true victim count might have exceeded 90. Medical experts testified about the telltale signs of arsenic poisoning found in the exhumed bodies, explaining how the poison accumulated in the victims' tissues over time. The court heard how arsenic caused excruciating deaths, with victims suffering from severe gastric distress, dehydration, and organ failure before finally succumbing to the poison. Family members of the deceased victims provided emotional testimony about their loved ones' final days. They recalled how Swanenberg had insisted on caring for their sick relatives, only to have them deteriorate rapidly under her care. The court also heard evidence about the small insurance policies Swanenberg had taken out on several victims, revealing her financial motivations. Throughout the proceedings, Swanenberg maintained an eerily calm demeanour. She showed little emotion as witness after witness took the stand, though she consistently denied any wrongdoing. When finally given the opportunity to speak, she claimed she was being framed and that the deaths were merely unfortunate coincidences.
The trial lasted 3 weeks, but the verdict came quickly. The prosecution had presented overwhelming evidence. 13 bodies exhumed from Leiden cemeteries. All 13 tested positive for arsenic in their remains. Arsenic that had accumulated in their tissues, in their hair, in their bones. Arsenic that had killed them slowly, painfully, while Maria Swanenberg played the role of concerned caregiver. The testimony from dozens of witnesses painted a clear picture. Maria had systematically purchased small amounts of arsenic from multiple pharmacies across Leiden. She'd taken out insurance policies on her victims. She'd been present for almost every death, usually the one preparing their final meals, always the one expressing concern when they fell ill. The judges heard about her own parents, murdered for whatever small inheritance they might have left, about her nephew, about the two young sisters she'd been babysitting, about the six people she tried to poison at those children's wake, about elderly neighbors who trusted her with their lives, about Maria and Hendrik Frankhausen and their infant son, the breakthrough case that had finally revealed the scope of her crimes. The evidence was damning, the pattern undeniable. Maria Swanenberg had poisoned at least 102 people over 3 to 4 years. At least 27 had died. Another 45 survived, but lived with chronic health problems. Many would be seen in the years to come, navigating Leiden streets on crutches, permanent reminders of what Maria's arsenic had done to their bodies. On May 1st, 1885, the judges delivered their verdict. Maria Swanenberg was found guilty of murdering 3 members of the Frankhausen family. Though the prosecution had built cases for 27 deaths, they'd focused on the strongest evidence for the verdict. The sentence? Life imprisonment. Maria Swanenberg became the first woman in Dutch history to receive a life sentence. The severity of her crimes, the scale of her betrayal of community trust, the number of victims, it was unprecedented. The Netherlands had never seen anything like it before. She was sent to the Gorkum Correctional Facility, where she'd spend the rest of her life. And she did spend the rest of her life there. Maria Swanenberg lived another 30 years in prison, dying on April 11th, 1915, at the age of 75. Her crimes fundamentally changed how the Netherlands approached poison control and criminal investigations. In the years following her conviction, Dutch authorities implemented stringent regulations on the sale and distribution of arsenic and other toxic substances. Pharmacies were required to maintain detailed records of poison sales and verify the legitimate needs for such purchases. reforms that remain largely in place today. Dutch law enforcement began developing more sophisticated forensic methods and standardized protocols for investigating suspicious deaths. The Swanenburg case became a cornerstone study in criminal investigation training, specifically in recognizing patterns of serial killings. But perhaps the most visible legacy of Maria Swanenburg's crimes walked the streets of Leiden for decades after her imprisonment. The 45 survivors, people who'd eaten her poisoned food and somehow lived, but whose bodies had been permanently damaged by the arsenic. Many of them navigated Leiden on crutches for the rest of their lives, their legs weakened by nerve damage, their organs compromised, their health never fully recovering. They were living reminders of how trust had been weaponized against the most vulnerable, of how a respected caregiver had systematically murdered the people who depended on her. Maria Swanenburg operated in an environment where death was so common that additional deaths went unquestioned. Victorian Leiden's disease-ridden slums created the perfect hunting ground. High mortality rates meant no one looked twice at another funeral. Medical knowledge was limited. Forensic science barely existed. The poor couldn't afford doctors who might have recognized poisoning earlier. But perhaps most importantly, Maria cultivated an image of compassion that made suspicion seem impossible. She was Goemi, Good Mary, the woman who helped when no one else would, the woman who prepared your dead for burial, who consoled your grief, who took in your sick parents when you couldn't afford their care. That's why she killed for years without raising alarm, not just because of Victorian medical limitations or because the poor died frequently anyway, but because she'd made herself indispensable, made herself trusted, made herself seem like an angel of mercy in a place where death was everywhere. The reality was that the angel was the killer. The mercy was murder, and the trust was the weapon. Today, Maria Swanenburg remains one of the Netherlands' most notorious criminals, not just for the number of victims, though 27 confirmed murders and 102 poisonings is staggering, but for what her case revealed about how serial killers hide in plain sight, how they weaponize compassion, how they exploit the vulnerable, and how for the 45 survivors who spent the rest of their lives on crutches in Leiden, visible, permanent reminders that Goemi was anything but good. Until next time, remember, trust can be the deadliest weapon. When survival depends on accepting help from others who seem most compassionate, anyone can become prey. Thanks for listening, friend.
Indulge in holiday cravings with the nutrition you need from Kachava's All-in-One Whole Body Shake. It's 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Savor the season knowing you're getting the good stuff your body craves. With Kachava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to Kachava, KACHAVA.com, and use code NEWS for 15% off.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.